and welcome to the reading of the Cedar Rapids Gazette for Monday, July 19th. I'm your reader, Kelly Neff. Let's take a look at the weather forecast as we get started. For today, mostly sunny with a light easterly wind, a high of 85, a low of 64. Tomorrow, mostly sunny, a northwesterly wind at 5 to 10 miles per hour, high 87, low 65. Then on Wednesday, partly sunny, wind out of the south at 5 to 10 miles per hour, a high of 86, a low of 68. Then on Thursday, mostly sunny, a southwesterly wind at 5 to 15 miles per hour, a high of 89, and a low of 71. Taking a look at today's top weather story from meteorologist Jan Reihard, warm, dry stretch ahead, with high pressure in control through at least midweek. We will continue to see a quiet weather pattern. Look for plentiful sunshine mixed with just a few clouds at times, but little to no rain through the work week. Temperatures start in the low to mid-90s this week, gradually rising to a little higher throughout the week. Long-range outlooks appear to keep this blend going with slightly above normal temperatures through the end of July and slightly below normal precipitation expected. This trend may even continue into August, with temperatures near normal to slightly above normal. When it comes to August precipitation, eastern Iowa has equal chances of seeing above or below normal rainfall. And that's today's top weather story from meteorologist Jan Reihard. Our top story on the front page today is by Gage Miskimen of the Gazette. It says, "For sale, Marion home revamped by students." Dateline, Marion. A house renovated by Marion High School students during the last school year as part of a partnership to create more affordable housing is now up for sale. The home at 330 8th Avenue is the first house renovated as part of the Marion Community Build program. The effort is a partnership involving the City of Marion, Marion Independent School District, and the Linmar Community School District. Under it, the Marion Economic Development Corp. buys deteriorating homes and students fully renovate them for sale to families with low to middle incomes. Through the class, students learn trade skills and work hands-on with tasks that go into rehabilitating a home. On Friday, the house, with three bedrooms and 2.5 bathrooms, was put on the market. When we were looking at this project, we didn't just want to extend opportunity in the classroom. We wanted to also look at it from a housing perspective, according to Nick Glue, the president of Medco, and he said that during an event last Thursday. Glue said Medco initially got involved in the project due to the Community Promise program that connects area youth to high-demand jobs in the region. For about three decades, local students have built new homes to sell. This is the first year students renovated an older home. Glue said that the program hopes to continue to find homes to renovate, completing one every school year. Medco bought the home in August, which had been unoccupied for at least a decade, for $60,000, and reallocated its current revolving loan fund to provide capital for the improvements. The city leveraged a portion of low and moderate income funds to assist with costs associated with the construction, maintenance, and sale. A few of the former students, now graduates, who helped renovate the home walked through the finished project last week. 18-year-old Caden Dalazal said, "It's really cool to see the transformation." Last fall, Dalazal and other students started working on the property, including cleaning up the lawn after the August 10th derecho. Other work included putting in new windows, siding, and various other projects inside and outside the house. 18-year-old Tanner Veit said, "I would definitely recommend taking this class. When I did siding, I got good at it and did the shed in my backyard, too. Marion Independent School District Superintendent Janelle Brewer said the idea to switch from building new houses to renovating old homes came in part to help give back to the community, but to also help students learn more practical skills for their own futures. Brewer said most students won't start with a brand new home purchase, but it is likely they will start with some home renovation projects. Plus, when you get to see where a house starts at and see where it ends up, there's some more pride in that. Glue said he hopes for a quick home sale and that plans to find the next house for the next school year will soon be in the works. Glue said last week, "We're hoping by the middle of the week to have an accepted offer, and we're in the market looking for that home, not quite ready to sell today, but with some work could be a great property. We will be actively looking and want to talk to people about their properties. We want to find homes in the heart of neighborhoods that could be a potential spark." Also on the front page is a story written by Michaela Ram of the Gazette, "Not too late to get the second shot." Thousands of Iowans continue to go without the second shot in a two-dose COVID-19 vaccine, according to the latest state public health data. About 64,000 Iowans have skipped, delayed, or otherwise missed receiving the second dose of the two-shot vaccine series as of July 2nd, according to the Iowa Department of Public Health. Of 95,362 people who have initiated the COVID-19 vaccine series, 64,076 have met the minimum interval or gone past the recommended time frame for receiving their second dose, according to state data. The minimum interval between doses for the Pfizer-BioNTech vaccine is 21 days. For Moderna, it's 28 days. Among the approximately 64,000 Iowans who have failed to receive the second shot, officials say 6,059 are between 1 to 7 days past that minimum interval. In early May, of the more than 275,000 people who initiated the series, 66,490 Iowans had not received their second COVID-19 shot within the recommended time frame, according to state data obtained by the Gazette. Even if individuals surpass that recommended time frame, experts say it's not too late to get that second shot. Dr. Pat Winokur, the infectious disease specialist at the University of Iowa Hospitals and Clinics, said it's important to get it as soon as they can. Winokur said research has shown individuals will achieve a strong immune response against the novel coronavirus if they receive the second shot beyond the 3-week interval. According to the U.S. Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, individuals can receive the second dose of the Pfizer-BioNTech or Moderna vaccines up to 42 days or 6 weeks after the first dose. However, federal officials emphasize it's essential individuals get that second shot as close to the recommended interval as possible. It's common for individuals to forget to go back for final shots in multiple-dose vaccine series. Scientists studying erratic intervals between doses in other vaccine series have found individuals' immune response still does well, Winokur said, even when they have a lackadaisical approach. Nearly 55% of Iowans aged 12 and older were fully vaccinated as of this past Wednesday, according to the state's coronavirus data. The total amounts, or accounts, for 46% of Iowa's total population. But the virus still has had opportunity to continue spreading across the United States. That means it has had the ability to mutate into new, more dangerous variants. As of June, a highly transmissible variant became the most dominant variant in Iowa. In the week ending June 25th, the state lab identified the variant in 53% of strains identified through routine sequencing. First detected in India in December, the Delta variant since has made a rapid sweep throughout parts of the world before it was first recorded in the United States in March. The variant accounted for about 52% of coronavirus infections nationwide, according to estimates from the CDC. Because it is spreading so rapidly, Americans have an increased chance of being exposed to someone infected by this variant, which increases their risk of becoming ill, according to Whitaker. Those who have both doses of a COVID-19 vaccine are protected against the variant. However, only one dose of the vaccine does not offer as much protection as two. Whitaker said, "We are going to see more breakthrough in infections in partially vaccinated individuals. A single shot of a two-dose COVID-19 vaccine series barely offers any protection against the Delta variant, according to a report published this month in the journal Nature. Scientists conducting the study did find two shots of the Pfizer BioNTech or AstraZeneca vaccine offer significant protection against the variant." Whitaker encouraged Iowans to get vaccinated and to complete their two-dose series if they haven't already done so. The more people who are immunized against COVID-19, the less chance the virus has to mutate into variants that could pose a greater risk. She said, "Every time it replicates in an infected person, it is undergoing mutations, and we're allowing the possibility for selection of a new variant that is less covered by the vaccine and is more transmissible and causes more death." On the front page is a story written by Kat Russell of the Gazette. Joshua Lathrop's widow looks for answers year after Hiawatha shootout. Dateline, Hiawatha. It has been a little more than a year since her husband was killed in a shootout at a Hiawatha mobile home park, and Sarah Lathrop said she and her family are still looking for answers. She said, "It's been very hard. You know, my kids lost their father. They have to grow up now without their father, and I lost my husband." Joshua Lathrop was killed May 30, 2020, at the Sunset Village Mobile Home Park, when an argument involving five people, including Lathrop, escalated to a shootout. After months of investigation, Linn County Attorney Jerry Vandersanden announced in February that no one would be criminally charged in Lathrop's death, given Iowa's Stand Your Ground self-defense law. Vandersanden ruled that Lathrop was the main aggressor in the fatal fight. He said, "Josh was the only one without a gun. He was the only one that was killed," Sarah Lathrop said. "It doesn't make sense that he's the only person getting blamed." Following the release of the county attorney's findings, she told the Gazette that she could not accept the decision, instead vowing to clear her husband's name. In the months that followed, Sarah Lathrop said she has filed multiple public records requests with the agencies that responded to the shooting scene that night, including the Hiawatha Police Department, the Cedar Rapids Police Department, and the Iowa Department of Public Safety, to gather as many pieces of the investigation as possible. She said, "I just want to find out the truth. Charging someone isn't going to bring Josh back, but it would be nice to have the truth, especially since Jerry has blamed Josh this whole time solely because of the blood alcohol level that night." The county attorney's report, which also cited other evidence and witness accounts, indicated Lathrop's blood alcohol level was 0.21% at the time he was killed. According to the county attorney's findings, officers were dispatched at 11:40 p.m. that day to the mobile home park at 530 Robbins Road in response to more than 20 emergency calls. In his findings, Vandersanden indicated the altercation may have stemmed from Tyler and Tyrone Bell, twin brothers, searching the mobile home park for two unknown men who allegedly attacked Tyler Bell's girlfriend. Witnesses said the brothers were searching the park, yelling they were, quote, "gonna get somebody," and Tyrone Bell was visibly armed. That night, Sarah said the couple was grilling in their driveway, maybe three lots from where her husband would later die, when Josh got a call from a neighbor, letting him know about the Bell brothers. Sarah said her husband did maintenance around the park, so it was not unusual for neighbors to call him for help. In his report, Van der Sanden said witnesses described Lathrop as drunk and, quote, in the mood for a fight when he confronted Tyrone Bell. The report stated Josh blocked Bell's path, demanded to know what he was doing and why he was armed, and ordered him to leave. By then, a small crowd, including park residents Chad Harris and Truman Harris, both armed, had gathered. Josh Lathrop then allegedly punched Tyrone Bell in the face, knocking him backward, and the shooting started, according to the report. Lathrop was pronounced dead at the scene, the report said, while Tyrone Bell, Tyler Bell, and Chad Harris each suffered multiple gunshot wounds. In his report, Van der Sanden said Lathrop's actions, quote, ignited a larger conflict. The county attorney ruled he deliberately confronted a person he knew to be armed, prevented that person from peacefully leaving the scene of the conflict, and assaulted him by striking him in the face. Sarah Lathrop said police reports contradict that. In an incident report written by Hiawatha Police Officer Chad Breininger, who was one of the first dispatched to the scene that night, he writes that Truman Harris told him Josh Lathrop was unarmed and, quote, trying to make Tyrone Bell leave. Harris told the officer that Bell, quote, got in Josh Lathrop's face, and the two men, quote, got into a scrap, according to the report. That's when Tyler Bell came running up and said, quote, Tyrone Bell pulled out his gun and shot Lathrop. Harris said that, according to the police report. Another witness, who was identified in the report as the original caller to 911, told Breininger that, quote, Joshua went up to Tyrone Bell and asked what the problem was. Then Tyrone unloads it on Josh. Sarah Lathrop said those two accounts indicate her husband was not the main aggressor. These two brothers come into the trailer court and they are walking around with guns and yelling very loudly to the point that neighbors a half a block away are concerned that they were going to get someone, she said. How is that not seen as aggression? The couple's 16-year-old daughter, who was with Josh until moments before he was shot, was one of the witnesses, but investigators never spoke to her, the widow said. The emotional wounds of the loss still feel fresh. Sarah Lathrop said, days like today when it's sunny and warm outside get me. That's when I start thinking about what we'd be doing, how we'd probably be riding his motorcycle or hiking with the kids. Sarah said she and Josh had been together roughly 20 years. She said, we got together the summer before I went into ninth grade and he was going into eighth grade. I didn't know he was going into eighth grade, or maybe we wouldn't have gotten together, because at that age, a high schooler dating a middle schooler, that's just not cool at all. They grew up together, she said. He lived across the street, so our whole families knew each other. His big brother and my big brother were, and still, are like best friends. She said life without her husband is a struggle for her and their four kids, ages 4, 7, 16, and 17. She said, it's hard on me, but I worry mostly of the kids and how hard this is for them. And the youngest ones don't really understand. They just know their dad is gone and they miss him. They just want their dad. Now turning to the Iowa Today page, we have a story written by Riley Wilson of the Gazette. Camp offers grief toolbox. For children coping with the death of a loved one, connecting with other kids who have been through the same thing can be an important coping tool. Camp Embracing Memories, hosted by Unity Point Hospice, is a chance for kids to make those connections. The free overnight camp gives kids from ages 5 to 16 who have lost a close family member or loved one the chance to learn ways to process their emotions and cope with grief. Jamie Sela, the bereavement coordinator for Unity Point Hospice, says, our goal of camp is to provide all the campers with a toolbox of coping skills to learn how to cope with death and grief and the feelings that come when we experience the death of a loved one. Sela said the camp gives kids exposure to different types of therapeutic activities they might find helpful. She said, we try to balance the opportunities to grieve and to express their emotions and also just to have fun and be kids. A big part of the camp is connection with the other kids and the camp experience, hayback rides, bonfires, and the fun stuff, too. One of the most beloved activities at the camp, which has taken place for the last 13 years, is memory pillows. She said they're able to bring an article of clothing from their loved one, and that's really to make that linking object where they're able to squeeze and have that pillow when they're missing them or thinking of them. The camp was Saturday and Sunday at Camp Lodis Ika in Solon. Stephanie Baker has been a volunteer at that camp for the past 9 years and brought her daughter help her navigate that process further. She said, "I think it was refreshing for me as a parent to see, because she didn't talk a whole lot to me about it and didn't want to talk about it. But when she spent time with these campers and felt like it was a safe zone, she opened up to them about it." Sela said the camp also helps caregivers learn about helping children through grief. Part of the camp offers caregivers a chance to connect with experts about helping kids cope with difficult emotions. She said that is an opportunity for those caregivers to ask questions about what they're experiencing, if they're having a difficult time with anything, to bounce ideas off professionals and connect with other parents and caregivers supporting kids in grief. Baker said the camp helped her realize that everyone grieves differently, including her and her daughter. She said she may not show the emotion outside that she's super sad, but internally she's super sad. It's okay that she's not showing the emotions outward at all, which was hard to accept because I'm the complete opposite. Beth Curtin, the hospice administrator for Unity Point in Cedar Rapids, attended the camp with her daughter last year. Her daughter, at age 14, lost her father when she was 3 years old. Curtin said, "When we opened up the forum to talk about it, it really was surprising to me how much she had held inside." She said, "We were able to have that discussion because of the camp. Otherwise, I don't think we would have ever really had that discussion." Also on the Iowa Today page, we have a story written by the Gazette staff, "Intoxicated Woman Shot Man in Northwest Cedar Rapids." Dateline, Cedar Rapids. A woman has been charged with reckless use of a firearm causing bodily injury after a man was shot early Saturday morning, according to a Linn County criminal complaint. Cedar Rapids police were dispatched at 3:55 a.m. to the 1600 block of F Avenue Northwest with information that a man had been shot, according to a police department news release. Officers found a man suffering from a non-life-threatening gunshot wound just above his hip, the criminal complaint stated. Cedar Rapids police, firefighters, and area ambulance personnel provided medical aid before the man was transported to a hospital. Diana L. DePolis was taken into custody at the scene and charged with reckless use of a firearm causing bodily injury, which is a Class D felony when not a serious injury, and carrying a dangerous weapon while intoxicated, which is a serious misdemeanor. She is being held in the Linn County Jail on $17,500 bond. In an unrelated case, her husband, Anthony DePolis, has been in custody in the Linn County Jail on a $250,000 bond since last July. He is facing charges of attempted murder, willful injury, and domestic abuse using a dangerous weapon for allegedly stabbing Diana in the neck after purchasing a knife, quote, in anticipation of using it to kill his wife, according to that criminal complaint. Anthony DePolis has a court hearing set for August 18th following a competency evaluation at the Iowa Medical and Classification Center in Coralville. His jury trial is scheduled to begin November 2nd. Here's a story written jointly by Aaron Murphy of the Gazette, Andrew Wind of the Waterloo Cedar Falls Courier, and Anthony Watt of the Quad City Times. The headline says, "Hundreds apply for open enrollment in Iowa." A new state law that bars schools from denying students from enrolling in other public districts in order to maintain demographic diversity is already having a significant impact on some Iowa districts with large minority populations. Nearly 140 students, almost double what the state's legislative analysis agency projected, have requested to open enroll out of the Waterloo Community School District. Waterloo has one of Iowa's highest minority populations. In Des Moines, nearly 300 students applied for open enrollment before the March 1st deadline. In Davenport, more than 100 students have applied for open enrollment. These numbers will be celebrated by supporters of the new state law, which they said was necessary to allow all students more choice in which school they attend. And they will be highlighted by the new law's critics, who will note the enrollment changes will leave behind higher concentrations of students with heightened learning needs and from low-income backgrounds. Before the new law, 5 Iowa school districts, Davenport, Waterloo, Des Moines, West Liberty, and Postville, had diversity plans that enabled them to reject requests for open enrollment to other public schools if that student leaving the district would create issues with the district's student diversity. The law, approved earlier this year by the Republican-led Iowa legislature and signed into law by Republican Governor Kim Reynolds, banned those diversity plans. Hundreds of families across Iowa are already taking advantage of the new law, and far more than expected in some districts. As of Thursday, the Davenport Community School District had 219 applications to transfer to another district for the 2021-22 school year, 117 of which were for family preference, according to school leaders. Had the voluntary diversity plan still been in place, only 9 of those transfers would have been approved unless families chose to pay tuition, officials said. The district is also attempting to contact the families of another 29 students who applied but whose requests to transfer were denied under the diversity plan. These applications are being retroactively approved unless a family changes its mind. School officials, however, expect the majority of those families to send their children to another district. Another 73 applications are classified as continuing enrollments, which means the families are moving to Davenport but want their students to continue their education in their former district. The district said this was higher than expected and could indicate decision-making based on the real or perceived reputation of the Davenport schools. The end of voluntary diversity plans in Iowa has led to a larger exodus of students from the Waterloo Community School District than was initially predicted. The Legislative Services Agency estimated this spring that 75 students there would request to open enroll out of the district this fall if the law was changed. However, since Reynolds signed the bill into law in May, 136 requests to open enroll out of Waterloo schools have been made, according to the district. Typically, the deadline is March 1st to apply for open enrollment, but the bill banning diversity plans extended that for the affected districts. The Cedar Falls Board denied 15 other requests to open enroll in from the Waterloo schools. All but 2 were for students going into 7th through 9th grades. Officials from the other districts said they have so far accepted all the requests received for open enrollment out of the Waterloo schools. Before getting confirmation from Cedar Falls schools, Waterloo administrators said 79 of the requests to open enroll out had been approved by the other districts, while 6 had been canceled. Waterloo school officials said the second highest number of requests to open and roll out was to Hudson Community Schools at 29. Hudson Superintendent Tony Voss said the district's school board has approved 28 requests, with at least 3 more on the agenda for this week's meeting. Voss said, "We've got capacity right now, so we're not turning anyone away at this point. We're wondering if there's going to be another run before school starts. That wouldn't be particularly surprising if that does happen." You are listening to the reading of the Cedar Rapids Gazette for Monday, July 19th, on IRIS, the Iowa Public Radio Reading Service for the Blind. Now, let's turn to today's obituaries. First, the other shorter notices. From Iowa City, Raleigh S. Yoder, age 34, died Thursday, July 15th. The Lansing Funeral and Cremation Service in Iowa City is in charge of those arrangements. From Tipton, Robert Thumb, age 63, died Friday, July 16th. Assisting the family will be the Fry Funeral Home of Tipton. From Quaskerton, Anna L. Alsup Straw, age 88, died Friday, July 16th. The Rife Family Center Funeral Home and Cremation Service of Independence will assist the family. From Vinton, Norval Richard Staten, age 88, died Sunday, July 18th. The Van Steenhuis Funeral Home of Vinton is in charge of those arrangements. From Wellman, William James Brown, age 96, died last Friday. Powell Funeral Home and Cremation Service of Wellman will assist the family. And in Williamsburg, Wayne M. Whitty, age 86, died Friday, July 16th. The Powell Funeral Home of Williamsburg is in charge of those arrangements. Turning now to the more in-depth funeral announcements. From St. Louis, Missouri, Susan A. Stickney, age 69, found peace at home on March 5th. Stickney is originally from Marion. Susan and her late brother Danny will be interred at 10 a.m. July 24th at Cedar Memorial. A celebration of Susan's life, followed by a memorial luncheon, will be held at 11 a.m. at First Lutheran Church in Cedar Rapids. David Bruce Bills of Iowa City passed away July 15th at the age of 67. A family memorial will be held, followed by a public gathering and reception from 5 to 7 p.m. Friday, July 23rd at Lensing's Oak Hill at 210 Holiday Road in Coralville. In lieu of flowers, a donation may be made to the charity of your choice. Kathy Lee Donham Vensky, age 80, of Iowa City, passed away July 13th after a long and valiant battle against multiple myeloma. On Saturday, July 24th, friends and family are invited to an open house visitation to greet the family between 2 and 4 p.m. at the Environmental Education Center at 2401 Scott Boulevard in Iowa City. For those who wish to stay, a memorial service to celebrate Kathy's life will be held at 4 p.m. in the same location. Private family burial will be held at St. John's Lutheran Cemetery near Sharon Center, Iowa. In lieu of flowers, memorials may be made to the Birdhouse Hospice Home of Johnson County, Iowa City Hospice, Community Crisis Center, or Paws and More Animal Shelter. Mark R. Kula, age 65, of Prairiesburg, passed away, surrounded by his family on Thursday, July 15th, at the Dennis and Donna Aldorf Hospice House of Mercy in Hiawatha. A celebration of life service will be held at a later date. Memorials in Mark's memory may be directed to the Mercy Foundation for the Hospice House of Mercy, which is at 701 10th Street Southeast in Cedar Rapids. Shirley M. McFarland, age 92, of Iowa City, formerly of Marshalltown and Estes Park, Colorado, died Wednesday, July 14th at the University of Iowa Hospitals and Clinics in Iowa City. Memorial services will be held at 11 a.m. Friday, June 23rd at the First Presbyterian Church in Iowa City, with interment in the church's columbarium. Visitation will be 1 hour prior to the services on Friday at the church. In lieu of flowers, memorial donations may be made in her memory to Iowa Public Radio, NAMI of Johnson County, or the Eastern Iowa Chapter of the Alzheimer's Foundation. Father David Hitch, age 80, of Tipton, died peacefully on Friday, July 16th, while under the care of Country Manor Memory Care of Davenport. Visitation will be held from 4 till 6:30 p.m. Wednesday, July 21st, at St. Mary's Catholic Church in Tipton. A funeral mass will be held at 10 a.m. Thursday, July 22nd, also at St. Mary's Catholic Church. Burial will follow in St. Mary's Cemetery. Going now to the community page, we find a guest editorial written by Norman Sherman of Coralville, who has worked extensively in politics, including as Vice President Hubert Humphrey's press secretary. He says, "The financing of political campaigns in our country is a mess. If money talks and candidates listen, we should all, regardless of party, be concerned about the integrity of political campaigns and thus government. There is a difference between a donation and an investment. You and I donate, and small donations have risen, both in dollars and numbers of contributors. But much more money comes from self-serving interests. Big and dark money is at record levels. In the last election, Joni Ernst and Teresa Greenfield raised over $70 million. Outside groups spent another $170 million here. Iowa was the second and most expensive Senate race in the country. I've tried to do my part in balancing that. I have been recognized for my generosity. If you give a little bit of money, say $50 or $100, to a couple of congressional campaigns, you make dozens of friends for life. In a single recent week, I had 51 requests, including 7 from Nancy Pelosi and 4 from the gubernatorial candidate in Nevada. It is an irritant, often, and a nuisance, always, but it is a democratic way to fund campaigns. If we could add more through public financing, as some other countries do, we might avoid the dollars and power of the super rich. My contributions are matched by George Soros on the liberal side, and David, who died in 2019 but whose dollars live on, and Charles Cook on the other. The Cooks are the second richest family in the world, worth $98.7 billion. They want to stop any legislation that deals with climate change. They want lower taxes and less government regulation. They have generously funded the Tea Party, and David was the Libertarian Party vice presidential nominee in 1980. Their influences extend beyond federal elections. A watchdog group has written, quote, the Cooks backed the American Legislative Exchange Council, an organization of conservative state lawmakers and business lobbyists. They've drafted model legislation that lawmakers have introduced to cut taxes, weaken environmental protections, and promote other conservative ideas. More than 600 of them have become law across the United States. While, as a liberal, I still deplore the influence of big money, not all money bags are created equal. Soros, a constant Trump target, is one of the world's foremost philanthropists. He has given away more than $32 billion to fund the Open Society Foundation's work around the world. He recently gave $500 million to Bard College. Beyond Soros and the Cooks, there are dark money bankrollers who have enjoyed freedom to pollute politics in the wake of Citizens United versus Federal Election Commission, a Supreme Court 5-4 decision in 2010 that struck down federal laws restricting corporate and unions from making expenditures in federal elections. It was unconstitutional, a violation of their free speech, thus treating them as individuals under the First Amendment. Citizens United has given life to the mess and sustained it. Its disappearance would be its greatest contribution. That's from Norman Sherman of Coralville, who's worked extensively in politics, including as Vice President Hubert Humphrey's press secretary. We have 3 community letters today. The first one is from Dennis A. Benda of Toledo, who says, seen on C-SPAN, Senator Joni Ernst complaining about inflation. Joni, in Iowa, it is Republicans in charge and Democrats. Does Ernst want to go back to when Trump was president and businesses closed down or had shorter hours? If people don't like what is going on under Biden, why is the parking lot full at places like Walmart? Joni, the reason Trump lost the popular vote twice is because most people, including some Republicans, see Trump as a crook. That's from Dennis A. Benda of Toledo. Here's a letter from Joe Snell of Cedar Rapids, who says, summer vacations when I was a kid meant Lake Okoboji and Spirit Lake. The Iowa Great Lakes were only a few hours from where my parents lived. We had a 1952 Buick stuffed with essentials. I was in the back seat with a box of comics. We went to the same resort every year and stayed in Cabin 3 for a week. The cottage was rustic but comfortable and not far from the fishing dock. The Iowa we lived in was a lakeland state, ranked 3rd after Minnesota and Wisconsin, with rolling hills and awesome bluffs as well as Lowe's shoreline. Later, we would drive all day to a resort near Park Rapids, Minnesota. We also had a winterized cabin overlooking the Missouri so we could see Iowa every day. Since the state has gone super red, we spent nearly $1,000 to place a filtration system in our home. When I worked on sabbatical with the Army Corps of Engineers, we had a nickname for water bodies that smelled and were slurry. We called them industrial lakes or scum ponds. Iowa is changing. A handful of people own land on which the runoff is changing the state to pond scum for the rest of us. We can change it back, and the polluters can still make a dollar or two. We are now growing trees after the derecho. We still live in the woods. Pollution need not be permanent. Woodsy memories can be pleasant for the rich and poor. And that's from Joe Snell of Cedar Rapids. Our third community letter comes from Mike Studkebler of Iowa City, who says, despite the headline, Grassley 87 shows voters he's keeping up, Senator Chuck Grassley is not, in fact, keeping up, and hasn't done so as someone who purports to represent all of Iowa. The final quote in that Monday article might as well have been about him. No one can tell Grassley what to do, and he wouldn't listen even if you did. Senator Grassley is deflective in his correspondence and demanding in person. Having spent my own money to visit him in D.C. a couple years ago, as he refuses to hold public town halls in Johnson County, he was dismissive to my concerns and unceremoniously booted my family and I from his office when it became clear he wasn't sitting with a sycophant. His retirement can't come soon enough. That's from Mark Studkebler of Iowa City. Turning to sports, the state high school softball tournament begins today in Fort Dodge, so we have a story from Jeff Linder of the Gazette, said it's Hall in the family. Dateline West Liberty. Go ahead, call them utility players. They probably won't mind. And if they do, Chad Libby will set them straight. Libby, who's the softball coach at West Liberty High School, said, sometimes the term utility has a negative connotation, but for all three of these girls, in this case, it's a compliment. They can all play any position and play it as well as anybody. For the Hall sisters, and Saylor is a junior, Finley is a sophomore, Pearson is an eighth grader, utility equals versatility, and versatility is a very good thing. Saylor said, it's nice having the three of us together on the same team. We all have different skills. Saylor splits pitching duties with senior Janie Gingrich and owns a 13-5 record and a 1.77 ERA. If Gingrich is pitching, Saylor likely is playing center field. Whoever is pitching is probably pitching to Finley. Pearson plays shortstop. So the Hall sisters routinely are staffing three prominent positions. Saylor said, we can all play different positions, and I think that helps us in the long run. When they come into bat, the top of the lineup is Pearson at leadoff, Saylor batting second, and Finley third. So, the announcer says, your first three batters in the top of the first, Hall, Hall, and Hall. Pearson leads the team in hitting at 4, and a run scored with 41. She has 23 stolen bases without getting caught. Saylor is batting 390, leads the Comets and runs batted in too, with 37. Finley, at 387, has the most pop with 5 home runs. She also has 12 doubles and 35 runs batted in. The Sailors take their act to Fort Dodge this week. The 8th-ranked Comets at 23-7 face number 3 Williamsburg at 31-10 in a Class 3A first-round game at 11:30 tomorrow morning. They don't agree on everything, but they are in consensus that they get their athletic gifts from their mother. Tricia Koenig Hall was a four-sport athlete at West Liberty, from which she graduated in 1993, then went on to play college softball. Their gifts come in different packages. Libby, who has taken the Comets to stay for the second time in 3 years, says Pearson is a lot faster, Finley has the strongest arm, and Saylor is kind of a combination of both of them. Personalities vary, too. Libby said, Saylor is sort of the leader, the spokesperson for the three of them. She has the most experience. She helps Pearson learn the new things. Finley is the hardest on herself. She's the most serious. She's hard on herself if she's not perfect. Pearson is the most fun. She's happy-go-lucky. That's probably the youth in her. They're all different kids, and you have to coach all three a little differently. Their common ground is competitiveness. Coach Libby said they all want to win so badly as anybody I've had. All three of them take it personally when they lose. They are each other's biggest fans and their own worst critics. As the eldest, Saylor tries, quote, to keep the other two in check. And Finley admitted, quote, Saylor keeps me under control if I'm a little rattled. We're all pretty vocal, good communicators. Libby said the dynamic between the sisters is great most of the time. The most common dust-ups usually involve the other two, according to Pearson, who said, hey, I'm the one that watches you two argue most of the time. But seriously, Pearson said, having these two, it has made the transition a lot easier for me. This is more fun than I've ever had. There's a fourth Hall girl on the horizon. Sullivan is 12 years old and will be a seventh grader in the fall. West Liberty has won 12 of his last 14 games, including a victory over Class 5A Top 5 Pleasant Valley. The two losses in that span came against 5A's number 1 Muscatine and Class 4A's number 4 ranked Carlisle. Saylor said, we didn't play the best when we played Williamsburg last time in an 11-3 loss on May 29th. She said, they might be underestimating us. She said, we have confidence that we can make plays and take it to the next level this week. The schedule for today at the state softball tournament shows in Class 1A, Newell Fonda taking on North Butler. Southeast Warren will play Sigourney. Wayne will take on Remsen St. Mary's, and Lisbon will go up against Clarksville. In Class 2A today, Wilton takes on Pella Christian, Earlham goes up against North Union, North Lynn will battle Iowa City Regina, and Central Springs will take on Underwood. In Class 3A today, Davenport Assumption plays Clark, and it's Atlantic against Anamosa. Also on the sports page is a story written by Justin Webster of the Gazette on auto racing. Dateline, Vinton. Jacob Floyd of Cedar Rapids spent his Friday nights at Hawkeye Downs for a decade before he hopped into a hobby stock at age 14 to race against his mother Candy and his father Jeremy. Floyd said of competing against his mom and dad on a weekly basis, it was pretty intense. It was a lot of fun and late nights in the garage. I started early and have kept it going ever since. Floyd wasn't able to race as much last season due to the pandemic and decided to take a step back this year to enjoy the sport as much as possible. We've hit several tracks this year, Floyd said, including Hawkeye Downs, Vinton, Marshalltown, and Independence. I've gotten too competitive in the past because I was points racing, and it gets frustrating. You need to have balance to keep going. The minute you slow down, you have more fun. Fun, after all, is what started the Floyd's racing 2+ decades ago when his parents just wanted a weekend hobby. Candy said, we just wanted something to do on Saturday nights. So we raced at Hawkeye Downs in the Women on Wheels division. Now that she can come to the track to watch her husband and two boys, as Jacob's younger brother JC also is a driver, Candy is more than happy with her decision to entrench her family in the sport. Candy said, it's amazing. You know where your kids are when they get into racing. They aren't going to get into drugs or anything like that because this is where their money goes. Not only does Candy usually know where to find her husband and kids, it's brought them closer than ever. Floyd said, when I started racing, all three of us were on the track together. It created this little family rivalry. It's just always been a hobby for us, and the minute we were on the track together, it increased that family bond. Although she no longer races, Candy is there every week to support her three favorite drivers. And next year, Jacob hopes to get JC into a hobby stock and have a new trio of Floyds racing side by side. There is also another driver Jacob is excited to see racing. It's his 7-year-old son, Lorenzo. Floyd said he loves it and is ready to get in one himself, but he has a few years. He'll be in a car as soon as he can, and he'll be out here with us. He and I will race together. That's how my dad and I started, and that's how he and I will start. While Jacob has struggled over the past few weeks at Benton County Speedway, the family still is very much in love with the sport and plans to keep showing up at local tracks. Floyd said, Cedar Rapids is great because you have Hawkeye Downs right there in town. Plus, it's so central to so many tracks. You hop on any highway and you're at a racetrack. So we'll stay local for sure. He said, support your local tracks and your local businesses and keep them open for as long as you can. High school baseball sub-state semifinals will be held around the area today. In Class 4A, Iowa City West will be hosting Cedar Falls. Linmar will be playing at Cedar Rapids Kennedy, while Iowa City City High will entertain Burlington. In Class 3A sub-state semis, Clear Creek Amana will be home against Davenport Assumption, Solon will host Carlisle, and Cedar Rapids Xavier will be home against Bondurant Farrar. On the community page is a story written by Riley Wilson of the Gazette. Its headline is simply, Back Together. Iowa City's New Horizons Band is returning to live performances for the first time in more than a year and a half with a new director at the helm. Tyler Strickland, a graduate student and the director of musical arts program at UI, took over leadership of the band at the beginning of the summer. Strickland said the group acclimated to playing together in person well, though it was an adjustment to direct so many people at once after so much time away. He said, it was a learning curve for me as well. Maybe I was just right there with them, and I think we all kind of learned together how to get back into making music as a large ensemble. Strickland said he has quickly gotten to know the band, which has around 30 members in the summer. He said, they are a great group of musicians that are really eager to play. They're just a fun group of people. It's been only 6 or 7 weeks at this point, but we've bonded quickly. Joyce Marner, president of the New Horizons Band, said the group has moved rehearsal spaces several times from parks to the Senior Center and finally an indoor space at Terry Trueblood Recreational Area. The band is preparing for its first post-pandemic concert July 26th at the Coralville Center for Performing Arts. Strickland said the band will perform around 45 minutes of music, including medleys of Disney music, Gershwin, and other favorites. The group also is performing at Willow Creek Park on July 31st. Marner said the group has settled into its new rehearsal space and is excited for the upcoming performances. She said, we're going to have to dig in and work a little harder to make this music sound as good as we know it can, even though we've had kind of a weird build-up to it. The band practiced during the pandemic using a program called Smart Music. Marner said, while the program allowed the musicians to keep their skills sharp, it's nothing compared with rehearsing in person. She said, the difference in experience between essentially playing alone to being in a group with other people playing together, that it almost brings me to tears because it sounded so good to hear somebody besides me. Some of the band members are retired musicians and music educators. Some played in high school or college, and some picked up an instrument for the first time when they joined the band. Marner picked up the flute around 15 years ago when she joined the New Horizons Band. She said, it's a little harder when you're older to learn something new, but that's the whole concept behind the band, to keep your brain going, keep your body going, and make some music. We have a couple of Eastern Iowa briefs from Linn County. Every 3 to 5 years, the Together Healthy Linn Collaborative, led by Linn County Public Health, assesses the health needs and assets of the community through a community health assessment. A community survey is one tool that is used as part of the assessment process. All people who live in, are employed in, go to school in, or visit Linn County are invited to complete the survey. Just contact the community health department. Completion of the survey will help gain insight on issues impacting the Linn County community's health and well-being. Also from Elkader, at 10 a.m. Friday, paddle the Turkey River with geology guides and naturalists from Dubuque, Jones, Jackson counties. Geology guide Ryan Clark from the Iowa Geological Survey will share some of the unique features along using the paddle that shape the landscape and make Northeast Iowa so unique. And that'll do it for today's reading of the Cedar Rapids Gazette for Monday, July 19th. I'm your reader, Kelly Neff. You can access a recording of today's reading on our website, iowaradioreading.org, at any time. Thank you for listening.